Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for Pod 40, From Dusk to Darkness. Tonight, we're on the case in Kell, Illinois, about an hour and a half east of St. Louis. The rural Midwestern town with less than 300 residents is the kind of place where everyone knows each other. It's also one of the last places you'd ever expect to hear about a child disappearing. But all of that changed when 10-year-old Amy Schultz simply vanished just steps from her home. The terrifying mystery would send investigators halfway across the country in search of answers and turn a trusting community into a town paralyzed with fear. July 1st, 1987. It was a warm summer evening in the small town of Kell. While Dennis Schultz was busy doing the dishes after dinner, his son Ryan had gone out looking for the family's dog. But when Biscuit returned on his own, Dennis asked his 10-year-old daughter Amy to find her brother and call off the search.
I told Amy, well, why don't you go into town and let Ryan know that Biscuit come home. I sent a flashlight with her because it was dusk at the time. It was 8:30, thereabouts.
It was a 5-minute walk that the young girl had made countless times through the safe streets of Kell.
It's kind of like the show on TV with Andy Griffith and Ron Howard. It's a Mayberry. Everybody had their doors unlocked.
Department Captain Michael Anthus.
Typical Midwest community. Everybody trusts everybody. Kids ran up and down the street. You could go borrow anything from a neighbor. What's mine is yours.
About a half hour after Amy went looking for her brother, Ryan walked in the front door alone.
And I said, well, where's Amy? He says, well, I don't know.
Ryan told his father he hadn't seen his sister. Dennis knew it was possible the two could have taken slightly different routes.
Once you get into town, then there's some small blocks, and you could be walking on the east side of town and the other person be on the west side of town and actually miss each other. So it was not unusual for something like that.
Still, Dennis was concerned. It was now dark outside. He jumped into his car to find his daughter. But there was no sign of Amy anywhere.
That's where it all started.
Dennis immediately began to fear that something horrible had happened.
Panic, sheer panic in my head, because the kids were very responsible. It was not like Amy to not be accounted for. It wasn't her character.
Dennis returned home and called friends and neighbors, but the mystery only deepened.
Some of the people in town saw her walking, and she said hi to them.
But when none of them could tell Dennis where Amy was now, he knew it was time to call the police.
What scared me the most was she was always punctual, always told Dad where she was going to be at. I'd never really had any experience with the police department before in my life, but it was very serious.
Dennis told officers what his 10-year-old daughter had been wearing: red shorts, a red T-shirt, and a pair of white sneakers. A massive search was launched.
They had roadblocks set up. They had the dogs out looking for her. They were doing their job.
Dozens of investigators from around the area descended on the tiny town of Kell, knowing that they were in a race against time.
We reached out for every asset we could get our hands on. They had a missing child. Law enforcement knows that it's the worst thing that can happen.
While the entire community joined in the effort to find Amy, Dennis Schultz sat helplessly at his kitchen table.
In case she came back. And so they know how to get a hold of me.
Dennis prayed there was an innocent explanation for Amy's disappearance, hoping that she would walk through the door at any minute.
I had no reason not to have hope that she would be okay, but your mind really plays a lot of crazy tricks on you. I was very terrified.
As the hours slowly ticked by, Dennis tried to hide his fear from 12-year-old Ryan. His oldest son, Adam, and the children's stepmother, Esther, were out of town that night and still didn't know Amy was missing. And that left Dennis Schultz to suffer through the hardest moments any parent could imagine alone.
There's no forewarning about what's going to happen, what you're going to do, what you're going to think. It was just a scary, scary night.
As the sun rose the next morning, police got the phone call they had been dreading.
We received a call from a maintenance worker that he had found the body of a young white female, apparently deceased, in a field a few miles from Kell, Illinois.
Sheriff's deputies raced to the scene to investigate the heartbreaking report.
When we arrived, we found the nude body of a young white female, face down, brutally murdered.
Even veteran investigators were stunned by the sheer violence involved in the crime. Special Agent Charlie Parker.
There was a large amount of blood. Her throat had been cut rather severely.
There was no doubt in the minds of the officers working the scene that the young victim was the missing 10-year-old Amy Schultz.
You still have to go through the formal identification, but there was no doubt in their minds that this was the young juvenile who had been missing the day before.
Just up the road from the young girl's body, deputies found clothing that matched the description of what Amy had been wearing.
They found a pair of white tennis shoes, a pair of white socks, a red blouse, and a red pair of shorts, along with a white pair of panties.
As officers studied the gruesome crime scene, it painted a terrifying picture of the 10-year-old's last moments alive.
She had some injuries to her face, to her mouth, where it appeared that someone had struck her. The way she was killed was brutal.
Investigators believed everything pointed to a clear motive for the attack.
I think the perpetrator snatched her up and took her out to sexually molest the girl.
Despite their outrage, detectives knew they had to keep their emotions in check and focus on collecting evidence that might help identify the young girl's killer.
When you have a victim who cannot tell you what happened, you must then just methodically process this whole open field.
We were able to recover some tire impressions near the scene of the body.
The clothes were also gathered up and bagged and taken into the crime lab to be processed. The body was taken into the hospital where an autopsy was conducted on her.
And police quickly realized the clues forensic experts had discovered might be the only ones they would get.
You hope that those pieces of evidence tell you something. Because there's no witnesses. There's no homes nearby where you go knock on the door.
The remote location of the crime led investigators to a chilling conclusion. Amy's killer most likely lived nearby.
Someone just didn't stumble across this place.
Those working on the case knew that finding Amy's killer would be challenging. But breaking the news to the 10-year-old's father would be far more difficult.
I got a call for me to come down there, so I went down there, and it was the sheriff. He said they found a body, and I just lost it.
Dennis was inconsolable.
And he just grabbed me and hugged me. I just kept yelling out, "Not my Amy."
The family's pastor spared Dennis the grim task of officially identifying Amy's body. And police decided to withhold the gruesome details of the crime.
They didn't tell me a lot of the information, I'm sure, to protect me.
The terrifying crime shattered the community. Amy's friend, Christy Ulls.
It was just like a piece of me was gone. My best friend, my classmate, wasn't going to be there. It was hard.
Amy's friend, Mark Simmons.
I can remember going to my bedroom and crying across my bed. It was pretty devastating.
The small town banded together to try to comfort Dennis and his family.
The deacons and the elders of the church and the whole community were really supportive, and there's a lot of love that was outpouring.
The heartbreaking murder became the prime focus of law enforcement in the region.
We had 35 or 40 investigators from throughout the state of Illinois holding daily briefings who brought different expertise to the table.
And each one of those investigators struggled to contain their outrage.
You just can't put together why someone would brutally murder a 10-year-old child. It's one of the worst homicides that I've worked in my whole career.
On the Case, the podcast, will continue in a moment. In the days following Amy's murder, Dennis Schultz wrestled with a flood of emotions.
I was very confused and mixed up. You have the love, the loss, the hate of who did it, the uncertainty of why it happened.
Amy had been his youngest and his only daughter, but it was her big personality that set her apart.
She was Daddy's little sweetheart. Always happy. She stood up for herself, especially with her two older brothers. She'd do anything that they would do. But she had her own personality. She was fearless, more fearless than me.
In the days and weeks following Amy's murder, neighborhood streets that were once filled with children were empty. Department Captain Michael Anthus.
The little town of Kell went to rolling up the sidewalks at 5 o'clock.
Prosecutor Gary Duncan.
The reality changed when this crime occurred, when people were afraid to send their children out. It was a devastating crime.
But while the community retreated in fear of an unknown killer, detectives were focused on finding him.
You have to be addressing those people that had last contact with her. Anyone that may have a vendetta against the family. Then you got to also look into the region. Do we have sex offenders around in the area? You just have to look at all those different angles.
Dennis told investigators that on the night of her murder, Amy's step-grandfather had seen her walking to town.
She stopped and then apparently asked William Willis to take her on into Kell.
Willis was in a rush and said no.
He was on the way to work. He passed her on the road and waved at her.
That story struck police as odd. The town was less than a mile up the road from where Willis had seen Amy. So they contacted his employers for his work records from that night.
There were supervisors who said he was logged in on time when he should have been logged in. The evidence was that he went to work.
After investigators were certain that William Willis had nothing to do with Amy's disappearance, they turned to Amy's autopsy report, hoping for evidence that might identify their next suspect. The medical examiner confirmed that the young girl had been sexually assaulted. He collected several hairs left by her attacker.
The medical examiner described it as a frenzied incident. It wasn't the kind of deliberation that sometimes a criminal of this type will undertake to do what he's going to do to that victim. And then he abandoned the crime scene. He did nothing to try to hide what he had done.
Forensic testing of Amy's clothing revealed additional clues. Special Agent Charlie Parker.
Fiber may have been from a car that she was in and transferred to her clothing.
Experts were able to help investigators narrow down the type of tire that had left the tracks at the crime scene.
We're almost 95% sure that the impression is a Cooper brand false persuader bias ply tire.
A secondary canvas of the route Amy had taken on the night of her murder also turned up a new witness.
We found a neighbor who saw Amy at about 9 o'clock p.m. walking south on Jefferson Street toward her home.
Based on the time of the sighting, police were convinced that the neighbor had been the last one to see the 10-year-old alive. And the woman had seen something else that seemed suspicious.
She noticed a car that had been in the area.
The car had been driving by right around the time the neighbor had remembered seeing Amy.
It was just a vehicle that she didn't recognize. She saw Amy, then she sees the car. It stuck in her mind.
The witness shared everything she remembered with police.
She said it was a light brown or tan colored car.
And there was one last detail that witness said, the car had long rectangular taillights. Police printed up flyers with a description of the car and a picture of Amy. A reward was offered for anyone with information about the crime. Even while Dennis was mourning the devastating loss of his daughter, he was doing whatever he could to help find her killer. And he started by putting up flyers.
I had put them around hundreds and hundreds of places throughout the whole area in hopes that it would lead to someone recognizing the car.
The information generated several leads, but ultimately none led police to Amy's killer.
It's a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, and you're trying to find all the pieces. We didn't discount any of those pieces because you just didn't know which one might eventually complete the puzzle.
Dennis spent every day searching for the mystery car.
I was out myself looking and going all over the place. You have nothing else to do. I mean, that was my whole goal.
And when Dennis wasn't out looking for his daughter's killer, he was making phone calls to Detective Anthus or paying a visit to the sheriff's office.
I'm sure they got tired of me hounding them all the time.
But 3 months after Amy Schultz's murder, investigators were no closer to finding her killer than they were on the morning she had been found. Then, Illinois police got a chilling call from law enforcement in Montana's Glacier National Park that sent the case in a whole new direction. The bizarre story Montana police would share began on a cold October night in Glacier National Park, 3 months after Amy's murder. Ranger Eric Morey was about to end his shift when he noticed a car on the side of the road in an area that was closed to campers because of bears.
It's kind of a brown, tan kind of a color, and I remember it had Illinois plates.
Morey approached the car to tell its owner that he was in danger and could not spend the night there.
Looked like someone had camped down on the lake shore. Bad place to be if it's, you know, in the fall in Glacier Park.
At that time of year, bears are looking for anything they can find to eat before they go into hibernation. Morey shined his flashlight inside of the car and saw a huge man passed out under a blanket in the back seat.
And I had to knock pretty hard and a couple of times and kind of finally woke up, just kind of in a daze.
The ranger was immediately struck by the man's appearance.
He looked like Charlie Manson on steroids. This great big Charlie Manson guy with long hair and scraggly beard and mustache. And, you know, he was really big and he took up the whole back seat of that car.
Morey was worried about a possible confrontation. The man's hands were hidden by a blanket.
I remember distinctly he looked at my eyes, and then he looked at my badge. Well, he's overly focused on my badge. You know, there's kind of something weird there.
Morey was able to diffuse the tension by offering to lead him to an area where he could safely spend the night.
He said, well, I'll tell you what, just follow me in your car and I'll take you to the campground.
The stranger was cooperative, and when Morey left the man that night, he hoped it would be the last time he would ever see that brown sedan.
I could see him as I drove out of the campground. He must have already climbed back in the back seat. And so then I went home for the evening.
But as he began his shift 2 days later, there it was, parked in an even more dangerous area of the park.
So now we're about 14 miles farther up the same road. And I see the car parked there, and it's really frosted over heavy. It was a hard frost that night, so it had obviously been there all night.
This time, the car was empty. And as the park ranger peered inside, he saw a note on the driver's seat. He opened the door to read it.
The note said something to the effect of, "The car's out of gas, I'm out of money. I don't want the car or anything that's in it. I signed the title, it's in the glove box. Whoever wants the car can have it. You can call my brother, my mother, here's the numbers. Thank you."
To Maury, it read like a suicide note. And he found more disturbing evidence that convinced him he might be right.
I specifically remember seeing a big knife sheath on the floor behind the driver's seat. What's the knife for?
Maury found the registration and another ominous clue in the glove box.
There's a little box of small caliber ammunition in there. It's a full box, but there's only just a few gone. So then I'm thinking knife, a few bullets. Was this guy around here somewhere dead?
Maury searched the area, but there was no sign of the car's owner, who the registration identified as Cecil Sutherland. Maury went back to the station to contact the missing man's relatives. But he was surprised by what he heard when he got them on the phone.
It was interesting. So I called and I got a hold of the brother first. I said, "Hey, I found his car." And I said, I'm concerned. Is he suicidal?" And he was flipping about that, laughing. "Oh, no, no way. And we don't want the car. You know, whoever wants it can have it."
A conversation with Sutherland's mother ended the same way. Cecil Sutherland's family appeared to want to distance themselves from him.
That was pretty much a fundamental thought I had.
Maury was still puzzled by the mystery surrounding Cecil Sutherland when, a few days later, he heard reports of a gunman shooting at cars on the same stretch of road where Sutherland's car had been abandoned.
I got a knot in my gut. I think I know who might be shooting at cars. That's got to be connected somehow.
More on The Case, the podcast, after this. Maury's instincts were right. The local sheriff's department and FBI eventually found an armed and dangerous Cecil Sutherland in the woods. Park Ranger Eric Maury.
He's been there for 10 days without a campfire or anything, and he killed a deer. He poached a deer in the park. He's there in this little hobo camp, you know, eating a raw deer. And it's just a miracle that he didn't have a run-in with a bear. And if he had, they probably would have buried him and we never would have found him.
Following Sutherland's arrest, park rangers contacted police in his home state of Illinois to see what they knew about the strange man they had just taken into custody. And a twist of fate had the call directed to Detective Mike Anthus, who was also in charge of the task force investigating Amy Schultz's murder.
I get this call from Park Service Police out in Montana. They had found an abandoned vehicle, and they were inquiring about the registered owner, Cecil Stephen Sutherland.
Anthus was not familiar with that name. The detective looked through his records and found nothing on Cecil Sutherland.
We looked through our leads system. We didn't have him anywhere in it. There was nothing that jumped out.
but he told Montana police he would speak with the man's family in person. As he drove to the address in Dix, Illinois, something clicked. Anthus realized he was less than a mile from Dennis Schultz's home in Kell.
It's by Jefferson Street, the last street that Amy Schultz was seen walking on that evening. And it's like the light bulb went on.
Anthus immediately turned around and went back to the station to call Montana police. It was just a hunch, but the detective wondered if the sniper in Glacier National Park might also be Amy Schultz's killer.
I'm going, what's the likelihood of this?
As a veteran homicide detective, Mike Anthus had learned never to ignore his instincts. And they were now telling him that it was no coincidence that Cecil Sutherland had lived so close to where Amy had disappeared. Now, he wanted to find out more about the car Sutherland had abandoned in Glacier National Park.
At that initial conversation, we didn't have details about the car. We were just following up on the registered owner and the registered owner's address. We get back on the phone. We're asking now more pointed questions about this vehicle.
The detectives hoped that the car might look like the one the eyewitness had seen following Amy.
It was a light brown or tan colored car, a two-door car, and it had square taillights on the back.
The car's color was a match to the one the witness had seen. The detectives asked for more specific information that might connect the car to the crime scene.
We asked then if they could tell us about the tires on the vehicle.
When Montana police revealed the brand and model of the tire on the car, Anthus was even more intrigued.
It was a Cooper brand false persuader bias ply tire.
It was the same brand of tire that left tracks at the crime scene.
We were almost 95% sure that that was the track.
A murder investigation that had gone months without a suspect suddenly had one. Anthus checked Cecil Sutherland's work records and discovered that he had still been in the Kell area on July 1st, the night Amy Schultz disappeared.
He worked as a maintenance person in a tire manufacturing plant. And according to the payroll records, he did not come to work on July 1st and July 2nd. And that he was at work days following that up to a point.
The records also showed he had skipped town just days later.
He left work and never came back.
Illinois investigators believe they now had enough to fly to Montana and question Sutherland behind bars.
I met with Mr. Sutherland at the county jail where he was being held by the federal authorities.
And from the very first moments of the interview, it appeared that Cecil Sutherland knew exactly why Detective Anthus was there.
I simply stated to him that we were working a case back in Illinois. I didn't go into what case, when, where it occurred, anything about it. Mr. Sutherland looked at me and responded that he knew right where he was July 1st.
July 1st was the date that Amy Schultz was killed,
the detective was stunned. He specifically hadn't mentioned that date or Amy Schultz's name to Sutherland.
How does any individual pull that date out of the air?
Perhaps realizing his mistake, Sutherland quickly shut down the interview.
He did not want to go into more detail about those events and refused to talk anymore.
But detectives weren't finished with Cecil Sutherland just yet. They executed search warrants that allowed them to collect samples of Sutherland's hair and check his impounded car for physical evidence connecting him to Amy's murder. It didn't take long for forensic experts to uncover evidence linking him to the crime.
They were able to recover fibers off of her clothing in his car. There were fibers and trace evidence from his car on her clothing.
Prosecutor Gary Duncan.
The likelihood of finding those kinds of matches in one place would be incredibly unlikely.
While the fiber evidence was compelling, the comparison of Sutherland's hair to those recovered from Amy's body was damning.
The pairs were an almost exact match.
Jefferson County prosecutors charged Cecil Sutherland with the kidnapping, sexual assault, and murder of Amy Schultz. On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. Mike Anthes called Amy's father to personally give him the news of the arrest.
Mike told me he knew they had the right guy. That just reassured me that they had the right person.
While investigators were confident that Cecil Sutherland was responsible for Amy's murder, they knew a conviction was not a guarantee. Department Captain Michael Anthes.
You still don't have any witness. You just don't have an admission. So you've got to take all of that circumstantial evidence and push it down to almost 100% validity.
But the detective believed the truth would tip the scales of justice in their favor.
I was told many years ago when I got into this profession that the truth will prevail. The facts are the facts. The evidence is the evidence. Even though it's circumstantial, it still paints a picture of what happened the night she was abducted and murdered.
A picture that is nothing short of hideous.
I think he overpowered her. Whether he use some excuse to get her close to the car or stop to ask a question. Can you help me find my dog? And young children approach total strangers trying to help because they're just not, you know, in tune to what danger they're getting into.
She was such a trusting little girl. If somebody had picked her up along the road and says, I just live down here, I'll give you a ride home or something like that, she probably would have gotten in the car and think nothing of it.
When the trial began, Dennis Schultz found himself in the same room as the man accused of killing his daughter. And Dennis vividly remembers exactly how he felt when he came face to face with Sutherland for the first time.
A lot of anger, rage, resentment. He killed my little girl. I wanted him dead.
And deepening his pain was the fact that Sutherland showed no signs of remorse.
None. 100% evil, 100% sociopath. It's all about him. He has no value except value for his own life.
Dennis testified at trial, hoping to convey to the jurors his tremendous sense of loss.
He hurt my little girl. He took my little girl from me. And it wasn't right. And he's a coward. And he needs to die.
In the end, the jury agreed. Cecil Sutherland was found guilty of Amy Schultz's murder and sentenced to death. But the case didn't end there. A decade later, Sutherland appealed his verdict and was granted a new trial. The courts ruled that prosecutors had overstated the strength of their hair and fiber evidence, and the passage of time had also given Sutherland's defense team a new potential suspect in Amy's murder. Prosecutor Gary Duncan.
William Willis, the step-grandfather of Amy Schultz, one of the last few people to see her alive, was outed as a pedophile. And this, in the minds of some, created a cloud over this case, suggesting that he might have done this thing to his step-granddaughter, Amy Schultz. And it became incumbent upon us then to prove that William Willis didn't do it.
Amy's father was shocked when he heard news of a second trial.
I was appalled. I was just devastated.
But Dennis Schultz refused to give up his faith in the system and the investigators who had worked so hard to solve the case.
So I got a hold of Mike Anthus. He was my go-to guy. And he says, "Don't worry about it, Dennis. We did it right the first time. We'll do it right the second time." And I had faith in him.
And you believe in what you have, and you believe in the people that helped you get to there. It'll stand the test of time.
Prosecutor Gary Duncan was just as convinced that the right man was behind bars. There was simply no physical evidence connecting William Willis to the murder of Amy Schultz.
Absolutely none. We had all the evidence from the first trial, and we went over that again and again.
But during the 10 years that had passed since the first trial, there had been advances in forensic science that allowed Duncan to strengthen the physical evidence he had against Cecil Sutherland.
DNA material was extracted from a couple of hairs that had been left there by the person who had raped and killed her.
Technology changed from 1987 to 2004. So now you're able to take new science and new technology and test our work.
The results confirmed what investigators had known all along.
It eliminates William Willis. It implicates, at a very high level, Cecil Sutherland.
The jury found Sutherland guilty of Amy's murder for a second time.
That was a huge relief for all of us.
But during the penalty phase, Sutherland's lawyers made a motion that stunned the courtroom.
His lawyer said that he wanted to plead to accept the death penalty. The death penalty plea was accepted.
At the time, the outcome was the best Dennis Schultz could have hoped for. The bereaved father believed he had come as close to justice as was possible, but only in the legal sense of the word.
The justice for me would be for him to have to go through what she went through, and that still wouldn't be justice, because she didn't deserve it, and he does.
But as it turns out, Cecil Sutherland will never face an execution date. In 2011, the state of Illinois abolished capital punishment. Governor Pat Quinn commuted Sutherland's death sentence to life without parole. It was another blow for Amy's family and the investigators, who still can't explain why he ever murdered a defenseless 10-year-old girl.
What kind of motive can there be? Something in this man was so depraved. He savaged this child for no reason. One of the saddest cases that I've ever had to be involved in.
Dennis Schultz has done his best to move forward with his life, but he'll never be able to put his deep pain behind him. To this day, his mind often replays the fateful night that Amy disappeared.
You know, I'll be driving down the road and scream at the top of my lungs. It's still there. It's still very real. And then sometimes I break down and cry a lot. It just happens. It's hard to control. And it's been 29 years since we lost Amy. But she'll always be 10. And that's not fair.
To honor his daughter's memory, Dennis Schultz helped create the Amy Center, a place for children to get help after suffering sexual or physical abuse. The Amy Center has worked with hundreds of children in its more than 25 years of service. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.